I'm actually in the deflation camp. I don't even believe in disinflation. Because if you think about, and this is a free economics degree for those who doesn't have it, I give you one in 10 seconds. If you take all of economics and boil it down to what really matters in economics, there are three things that matter, and two of them are relevant for this question. One is demographics, so the net change in the demographic, and the other one is productivity. Productivity is the single most important factor. If you live in a productive country, if you own a productive equity stock, you can never lose money simply by the definition of productivity. And of course, the final one being the marginal cost of capital needs to dictate where capital goes.
Hello and welcome back to SOAR Financially, where we discuss the macro to understand the micro. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the JR Mining guy on Twitter and the CEO of the SOAR Financial Group, and tremendously appreciative of you joining us here yet again for another interesting discussion on the macro landscape. There is so much going on, especially this week. I've posted it on Twitter and also on in our YouTube community notes. The Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and of course the US Fed are meeting this week and making their interest rate announcements. And we're being provided with lots more other data points out of Europe, out of Japan, out of China. We've been provided with some interesting data this morning as well. So lots to talk about and lots to make sense of, because of course everybody wants to know where are things headed. It seems like we're in a market melt-up phase, especially in the US. The S&P is still rallying, but also other asset classes. Gold is near an all-time high. Bitcoin has been at an all-time high. Many other asset classes rallying as well. Copper is showing signs of life. So I'm really curious where things are headed. And I think I've invited the perfect guest for this discussion. It is Steen Jakobsen. He's the CIO over at Danish Bank Saxo Bank. And I'm really excited for him to join us. Steen, it's a pleasure to meet you and thanks for making the time.
It's a pleasure being on your show, Kai. I look forward to the conversation.
Absolutely. No, Steen, really appreciate it. And why don't we just dive right in and let's start gauging a bit of the macro landscape that we're in. Like, how healthy is the economy right now and the financial markets?
Well, depends on what angle you want to go at it from. If you look at the growth rate, if you look at the consumer spending, of course, most people will tell you that the economy is in a great shape. But what is beneath that and what is really driving it, of course, is that we've had an unprecedented fiscal boost from the U.S. And through the fiscal boost, we have spent in the U.S. $3 trillion, and we've had an output to show for it at $2.4 trillion. Of course, a net loss of $600 billion. So, you know, depending on whether you want to focus on the debt side of why we have the growth or whether you want to focus on the data right now, the answers are two different ones. One is that it's kind of okay, and the other one is that we are really just spending money from the future in terms of increasing the amount of debt loads. And I think probably the single most important thing I can say to your viewers is, remember, 2024 is a year where 50% of the world population go to the polls. Why is that important? It's important because nothing, absolutely nothing, can or may go wrong in the economy and the stock markets in 24. That sets up this kind of almost artificial market where we are playing monopoly in the equity game, where we are just waiting for the paint to dry on the cost of capital. And at the same time, we see the social inflation, the social contract is under heavy attack across the board. And of course, it will show up as one number one topic, in my opinion, in the US election.
Absolutely. No, fantastic, Steen. Again, I just took a full page of notes while you were chatting. So lots to follow up on, of course. And I think that we need to discuss what kind of landing scenario you're envisioning also, just to get the mindset for this conversation, because we're always seemingly doom and gloom on this channel. But it's tough to get away from the macro indicators, leading indicators, but also lagging indicators. It's tough to get away from that doom and gloom scenario. Right, so I'm curious, Steen, what camp are you in? No landing, soft landing, very hard landing? I'm curious what you're thinking.
I'm not a philosopher. I'm not even a good economist. I'm a practitioner. I'm a guy who managed money and tried to make a little bit of the green ones week by week and month by month. And I think the way to approach your question is really just to say, in my lifetime, I've never seen a recession with full employment. That is sort of the simple answer to your question. In order for things to deteriorate on the economic side and for the doom and gloom to actually become a front page news story, we need to see a significant slowdown of the labor market. I think, as it happens, that is coming. But again, 24 is an unusual year. Many moons ago, we coined the phrase of pretended extend, pretend that you are having integrity and extend by buying time. And 24, in my opinion, is already a lost year in economics, in socioeconomic standards, and certainly for the markets. 24 is a year where the manipulation will be at the forefront of everything. So landing or no landing doesn't really matter. What you need to focus on is the fact that we come off a period with huge fiscal spending, which is going to be difficult to repeat in 24 because it is an election year. And at the same time, the economic data takes longer to sort of work out the positive momentum that you created from COVID, the post-COVID open up of the economy, and then the massive stimulus that President Biden and his colleagues in the cabinet has been pushing into the U.S. economy. It's unprecedented. As you can probably tell with my leg of hair, I've been around for more than four, this is my fourth decade. It's probably a diplomatic way of phrasing this. And I've never seen this amount of debt before in my life. And yeah, I respect it as a market player that this is a slow moving train. It's a little bit like a freight train leaving the platform. It's not a TGV, it's not a fast, rapid 300 kilometers an hour a Chinese express train that is leaving. It's a freight train. And the impact on monetary policy, the sort of wish of the market to get day by day confirmation of data signals is not happening simply because it takes time to work all of these impulses and the sizes of these impulses through the economy.
No, absolutely. And I've been writing down, again, a few comments that I want to follow up on. And let's start with the labor market there, Steen. And you're seeing cracks, and I'm curious, like, where are those cracks coming from? Because I'm trying to understand a bit of the fundamentals, the underlying fundamentals. Like, where is it happening? We've seen UPS lay off 12,000 workers, which usually doesn't happen in a great economy. But I think you mentioned, or somebody else mentioned, LA port data that is increasing as well. So you need more workers as well. So I'm curious, where do you see the cracks appearing in the labor market?
So the U.S. economy is a 70% consumer-driven economy, which, of course, makes L.A. ports important for the import side of the economy. But where we look at the labor market, it is extremely confusing, even for a veteran like me to interpret the data. I mean, we are suggested that non-farm payrolls makes any sense. I think anyone who've ever spent more than 2 minutes looking at the non-farm payroll knows that the revision is in excess of 50% month by month, and all of the sort of adjustment that you see to non-farm is negative. So the data point as a valid sort of statistical element in your predicting the labor market is zero. What many economists do today and a lot of hedge fund use is warm noses, the fact that in the US, if you have to lay out, I think it's more than 20 people, you have to put in a warm notice ahead of time. Those are increasing. We see that the retain of talent is difficult. And the leading indicator that people use is the quit rate. And why would the quit rate be so important? Because the confidence of the employee is reflected in that number. Less people are likely to be quitting their job if they think they are not having better opportunities elsewhere, or they're a little bit nervous about their own job. So those are already showing up. And if you look at the even if you look at the base book and you look at the economic activity, it's pretty much 50-50 through the districts in the U.S., whether you see economic activity or a little bit of a slowdown of the activity. So again, I'm back to my sort of my ice melting analogy of things being very, very slow. But at the margin, we are seeing not a total collapse in the labor market yet, but we're definitely seeing a normalization. We're seeing that the jobless claims, the running tally, but also the four-week average is edging north. But all of these sort of high-frequency data that we look at is actually flashing that we probably see a significant increase in the unemployment over the course of the March months, the April months, and the June months.
Absolutely. You know, interesting tidbits there. Like the quit rate is really, really interesting because the confidence number, as you said, so based on the analogy, like the quit rate should be fairly low because people are worried that they won't find a job elsewhere, right? So I think that's pretty obvious. Just anywhere you look, you don't really want to switch jobs right now because you try to improve when you switch jobs. You don't try to, you know, downgrade your position as well. So another interesting point you mentioned there was the debt side. And I briefly tried to, you know, look up U.S. presidential candidates and their stance on the U.S. debt. And I couldn't find much. Both candidates haven't really announced much yet in terms of program they will be running on. But the U.S. debt is not a topic highly discussed, or that's being discussed a lot. And we're sitting at $34.5 trillion of U.S. debt right now. I think debt service payments, I think, which is an interesting factor, is over $1 trillion now, right? And you mentioned monetary policies. So, like, how does that fit all together? Like, how do you see this developing? You said pretend and extend, of course, but how much further can we kick the can down the road there, Steen?
Well, if you ask Janet Yellen, you can continue forever because no one is doubting the ability of the U.S. to repay its debt. But I think the market, to some extent, in the third quarter last year was disciplining the bond market and the U.S. government in the process. Of course, what I'm alluding to here is the fact that we saw a sky-high 10-year interest rate above the 5% handle, and that really scared the market off. To some extent, we already now, again, retesting kind of the lows because of the massive issues we see. But as the U.S. is a lender of last resource, they can go to the basement and print as much money as they want. But having said that, there is, of course, a limit to how much the market will be able and willing to accept. And one of the issues that we're going to meet in the next quarter is actually this net liquidity availability to buy what the U.S. government is issuing. One of the main concerns here is what is called the reverse repo. For people who's not familiar with the reverse repo, it's a little bit like a parking lot for excess capital from the banking system. That has been drawn down, and that has been a positive impulse to the equity market because, of course, as this money goes out of the sort of Fed, it goes into the banking system that then can use the multiplier to use it. We are seeing that bank net lending adjusted for inflation is negative. So the banks are not providing additional liquidity to the system. And on top of that, we have, of course, the QT continuing somewhere between $80 and $100 billion a month. If you add these three numbers together, the ability of the US Treasury and through the Fed to go to the market and find buyers is getting increasingly difficult. Hence, we see the incremental increase in 10-year bonds. So, you know, again, I'm sorry, I'm so diluted in my answer, but the answer is there are no black and white. And I know, especially financial press loves to have black and white. My customer loves black and white. But the fact here is that the big issue that the economy faces, despite the good labor market, despite the good growth rates that so far is in the numbers, we have a liquidity constraint going into this month. And that probably also means, as we look ahead to March, a Fed meeting, the market is focused on whether we're going to get two or three dots, but Fed is going to be concerned about how do they tweak the QT, either by pausing it, indicating a halving of it, or in any shape or form, making sure liquidity is ambulant and is ample enough in the system. Don't forget that, and people forget that in economic history, that 9 out of 10 rate cuts that we've seen for Federal Reserve have been based on illiquidity of the market, not because we had a recession, because basically we haven't had a real recession for a number of decades. So Federal Reserve will always have a priority number 1, 2, and 3 on the liquidity on the market. And that's probably where one of the biggest gaps right now is between how I see the market and how the average pundits see the market. They are concerned about, oh, is Fed going to do 2 or 3 dots? I go like, I couldn't care less, because I have a golden retriever. She's called Nelly. She's 10 years old. She's predicted the dots better than any of the Fed board members over the last 30 years. So, you know, it's a random walk, a process in terms of those dots. That doesn't mean anything. But because the market is so data point, by information focused, they make it into something that is significant. But what is significant for the Federal Reserve is the slowdown that they see in the labor market gradually. But more importantly, the illiquidity risk and the fact that they end up in a situation where there isn't ample enough liquidity in the system to sort of juice the engines.
Stine, I'm venturing into an area that I know very little of, admittedly, and that's the Bank Term Funding Program and how that sort of works. Because I know it is running out at the end of this month, I believe, as well, which could be a huge liquidity factor. Since you brought up the topic of liquidity, I wrote that down as well. I just want to seek maybe some clarification and understanding of what that actually could mean as well. Because in combination with QT, the quantitative tightening, the reverse repo facility running out of funds as well, like how much more could that, or how much more can the system take in that regard? As well.
So the bank funding program, of course, was initiated post the SVB bank failure that we saw in March last year, so exactly 1 year old. And now, as you say, they are retiring it, not end of the month, actually this week or last week, it was being retired. Okay. However, the way it works is that up until the closure of the program this week, you could still do 12 months forward. So the real impact is 12 months going forward, and the net size, last time I checked, I think it was about $175 billion, is also disappearing from the system. But that's one of these exogenous factors in sort of the overall liquidity factor. It is not positive, but it's not super negative. But it will have potentially impact if I'm right about the slowdown in the overall activity, if I'm right about the slowdown in the aggregate liquidity pattern, then, of course, we could see an increase focus on the regional banks and their ability to fund themselves. And of course, this topic has not become smaller, considering that the commercial real estate books of these banks are significantly higher than the major center banks. So there is still something out there in all of this positive sort of the momentum, the election year stimulus that we see that can sort of bring about the surprise to the marketplace.
Talking about surprise to the marketplace, and I mentioned to you, I'm going to ask about commercial real estate as well, because the market seems to be ignoring it, in my opinion, just looking at the S&P. Everything seems to be honky-dory. Everybody's worry-free, right? How much of a risk is the commercial real estate market, in your opinion, given the lag effects and what we're seeing right now in terms of refinancing some of those mortgage rates?
The best way to answer that question is to look at the profile of the actual refinancing that needs to happen. So if you look at for the helicopter perspective, Fed needs to finance the banks, they need to finance the treasury, and they need to make sure the refinancing of commercial real estate and private equity is happening over the course of the next 3 years. That is objective number one for the system itself to bring that about. And if you look at the CRE and the maturity profile, 25 is really the big year for commercial real estate. In 24, what we've seen in the credit market so far has been an ability for the best of the credits to get refinanced at, as you can see from the credit spread, at reasonable rates. I think 25 is a very different story. One, because it will be time plus 1 year away from here. And I think the overall economic pattern, the ability of banks to lend will then be at its full negative forced power in terms of the ability. So for me, you know, the banks, as I talk to them around the world, are very keen on lending money to industry, to AI projects, to financing of infrastructure, green transformation. They are far more, far bigger, more fearing the commercial real estate and consumer lending right now. And of course, I think that is another reason why we have to be slightly cautious, still accepting that 24 is a pretend and extend and a nothing year. But 25, I think, is a different story.
No, appreciate that answer there. I'm curious, like, how is the Fed taking that into consideration now, what you're saying, like pretend and extend, meaning is that higher for longer, or can they actually proactively manage what is going to happen in 2025? And we all know the Fed is usually not forward looking because they rely on lagging indicators, economic indicators, right? So trying to make the segue a bit to the Fed discussion now as well, but I'm curious, like how much are they taking that into effect, and how much can they?
They're absolutely taking into effect, because you have to remember the Federal Reserve has tried to reverse engineer those three challenges that I just outlined. And if they do that, they will be more likely than not to cut interest rate. Because if you live in an economy which needs refinancing and has a high level of absolute debt, what is the single input factor that can actually drop the burden of that? That, of course, is the forward yield. It is the forward cost of capital, relatively speaking. And as you and I talk, you know, depending on how you measure it, real rates in the US is somewhere between 200 and 300 basis points. Doing refinancing at a positive 200, 300 real rates environment is almost impossible for the not just for the US, but for the global economy at large, because we are simply not there in terms of productivity. We are not there in terms of capital use. It is increasingly public spending that is driving the overall growth rate. So the mix is wrong. And for Fed, the only thing they can do, and playing to the pretender extent, it is to be at the first ability, at the first data set that confirms their theory, they will be cutting interest rate and far more aggressively than the market thinks, because that is the way they solve the obligation of the small and regional banks, the commercial real estate business, the private equity, and everything that sits in that structure of needing lower funding rates.
Let's talk about the lag effects going into the rate cut decision as well, because let's assume a 25 basis point cut. Like, A, how long does it take to filter through the system? And B, how meaningful is that even, right? Even looking forward, because 25 basis points, it's pretty much a nothing burger, quite honestly. So I'm curious, also maybe as part C of that question, how symbolic is a rate cut as well? And what could be the ramifications? What could the market interpret into that?
You're absolutely right. 25 basis points on the margin doesn't really change the projection of the economy. But what it does do is it stops the higher and higher level of financing costs to the U.S., to the CRE, and to the banking system. And in order to get this down, we need to see interest rate by this time next year needs to be at least 100, if not 200 basis point lower. We basically need to take away all of the positive real days that we have. Let's assume it's about 200 basis point positive now. We may be able to do all of these refinancing at 50 basis points positive, but I doubt it, because if you look at the average real rates that we had over the last decade, it's been negative in the case of the US, in Japan, in Europe, in the UK, and in the US. So to me, we need the 200 basis point. And the first cut, I mean, if you think about the challenge we have in the market right now, we know what the path is going to be, that's lower. We know where the target is, that's down to 2% inflation. What we do not know is when we start. So it is significant when they start, sorry. So what is significant in the first 25 basis point is not the 25 basis point itself. It could also be 50 if, you know, the longer they stay higher for longer, the more they will need to cut eventually. That is just that mathematical truth. But the fact is that will start, that will initiate the sort of the downside on the cycle and confirm that the Federal Reserve is no longer in a position of wait and see. They are definitely not in a position that has sneaked into the narrative recently that they will not cut interest rate in 24. So, you know, if answered differently, two, three months ago, 25 basis points wouldn't have made a huge difference. Now it makes a huge difference only because it's reassess and reset the trajectory to one where we're going to see a multiple number of cuts in order to deal with and mitigate these incoming refinancing needs in the three big sectors that I talk about.
Okay, fantastic. No, Steen, thanks for clarifying that. Really interesting. Let's come at it from a different angle. We've talked unemployment as well. Let's talk inflation, because that's the other big job that the Fed has, is control inflation. And do you see inflation under control? Official numbers are at 3.2%, a little higher than forecast last time. Trueflation, another indicator, sits at around 2.1%. So I'm curious, has the inflation beast been tamed, Steen?
I was a big inflationista in a couple of years ago. Now I'm actually in the deflation camp. I don't even believe in disinflation, because if you think about, and this is a free economics degree for those who doesn't have it, I give you one in 10 seconds. If you take all of economics and boil it down to what really matters in economics, there are three things that matter. And two of them are relevant for this question. One is demographic, so the next change in the demographic. And the other one is productivity. Productivity is the single most important factor. If you live in a productive country, if you own a productive equity stock, you can never lose money, simply by the definition of productivity. And of course, the final one being the marginal cost of capital, needs to dictate where capital goes, but that's not irrelevant for this. But if we look at demographics, obviously we will see a significant decrease of people in the working force globally over the next couple of years, which is deflationary in itself. And then we come to the big two-letter words that everybody wants to talk about, AI. I'm too old to actually talk about this because most of the young viewers would say I have no clue. But for my chair, AI is significant in the science space, far more than this interface link that's done so you can do your thesis in university in 5 minutes and whatever. But if you look at what's going on right now in energy, in fusion energy, the computer power and harvesting that and using AI intelligence means that, and I know a lot of commentators is criticizing me for this view, but I do think inside the next 5 to 10 years, we will put fusion energy at scale into the energy system. And that will take significantly down the cost of energy. It will also at the same time solve, because there are no negative impact from it environmentally, the pollution that goes on in the world. I actually think, Kay, to be honest, that, you know, answering your question, we need to look for what happens in the next 10 to 15 years. There is bigger than a 50-50 chance that the marginal cost of energy is moving towards zero in the next 10 years, far more so than this doom and gloom story that oil is going to 250 because there isn't enough of it. And if I put that into the equation of what is ongoing at company level, so from here we did it from the top down, now I'm going to do it from the bottom up. You know, if you look at law companies, if you look at any data set that has a limited parameter around it, limited use, AI is a genius construction for that because it doesn't iterate new concept. It doesn't, as we've seen in Google's example, we don't redefine history with different characteristics. But if you have a finite data set in science, in law, in robots, probably on customer servicing, it's going to be a huge boon for the productivity. We're already starting to see productivity is kicking up. And that's one of the things the Federal Reserve is certainly looking at, that all of a sudden from, you know, 0 to 1 productivity range, we are now in a 2 to 3. And if I look back to, and you probably remember that as well, Kai, if we look back to the sort of the hay years of 97 to 2000, when we had the last boom and bust, that was driven by a huge amount of productivity gains. And if I'm right about productivity and investment into productivity is going to happen, then inflation is just a cursory concern because the supply side will be solved by exactly these same means that we operate here. And being exposed as I am to shipping and other industries, I don't really see that the cost of delivering product is getting more expensive. Yes, we have the Middle East concerns right now in terms of shipping through those lanes. But remember, if you are a VLCC, a supertanker ship, your cost of transport is, you know, into small 1 to 2% of the total cargo price. So we're not talking about, you know, things that's going to be detrimental to the outlook. So very much in a deflation camp after having been inflationista for a long time, because I really saw the green transformation putting things out of whack. Mm-hmm. Now I think people are pushing back on the green transformation. Rightly so, in my opinion, not because the end goal is wrong. I very much believe we need to do something for the environment, but I think we do it through doing better energy distribution and energy which has far less pollutive and in that sense controlling it through, as we've always done in human evolution, we've done it through progress, not because, and let me put this out because this is my favorite analogy. So think about green transformation. So if wind and solar was the solution, that is the scientific equivalent of going back to burning woods and coal because they have the same density of energy. Never in history have we created a solution where we would move backwards in terms of energy density. We need higher density, cheaper density, cleaner density in terms of energy. That's why we didn't fail on having the right objectives. We failed on actually delivering what makes sense for society, which is a productive way of solving the problem. I mean, we could solve for the vaccine for the COVID inside 12 months. We did the Oppenheimer movie, just made it big in the Oscars. We did the nuclear bomb when it was needed to be done on the research basis. Why can't we get together and actually solve the world's problem on the energy side, getting marginal cost of energy to zero? And think about just conceptually, if we get any marginal cost of energy to zero, we can deal with all of the poor countries in the world through what? Desalination. You can make the, you know, the most dry desert desalinated through an energy that is at margin cost of zero. We can go, we can create, you know, forests, and we can recreate society. We need to be thinking bigger. I'm embarrassed as we, that we as a human mankind think we can tax and pollute ourselves to a better future. We need to develop. And that fits into that inflation question you ask. I know it's a long answer, but I think it's a critical one, because I think the tectonic plates are changing towards something globally which is more productive. And that's what comes after pretend and extend. We will, in my opinion, be, I know you run a, you say yourself, you run a doom and gloom program, but I'll be the first one to say, being an old geezer as I am, that I think the next 10 to 15 years is going to be the most productive in human mankind's history.
No, it's like we try not to be doom and gloom, but it always ends up being doom and gloom. That's the thing, because we always look at short-term indicators. And like, as you probably say, we probably don't think big enough, right?
Yeah. So, and rightly so, because it's difficult, because, and that's one of the problems. I read someone, a great comment this morning, I think in the Wall Street Journal, that someone in Chicago on the street was commenting, I don't understand the economist's version of the world. They say I'm having real wages increases. But the fact is, when I get my paycheck, I still live paycheck by paycheck. I may get a higher nominal salary, but everything else is equally, if not more, expensive. That's also why politically in the opinion polls, you see that inflation is the biggest issue. And the government goes like, oh, but there's no inflation. It's coming down. Look at the success we had. Yeah, but that's one a misuse of the inflation measure for what it actually represents. But secondly, that there is the social contract is broken.
Sedin, you touched on the oil price real quick in your answer just before. And I wrote down one question: is the recent oil price spike, is that going to cause stagflation? And stagflation means, you know, higher inflation but weakening economy, right? Is that something you're witnessing right now? It's more of a short-term question, again, coming from that big picture approach that you just had. But it's more of a short-term question. I'm curious what maybe ramifications are, because it seems like some of the inflation pressures at least were relieved by lower oil prices.
As an investor, it suits me. I really think this cycle is about commodities. So, of course, as you know, most indices that you trade in commodities is supported by the net movement of oil in it. I think there is some supply issues. I still think there is a net demand, because what has happened practically is that we have moved from an agenda of green transformation, you know, supposedly solving everything, to understanding that in between getting to a better point 10 years or 15 years from now, we actually still need to be fossil energy dependent. And if we need to do that, we need to be doing it in a more efficient way, and some in a way which is less pollutive. So to some extent, I think the ability of doing sunsets on investment and the likes is still not happening. So yeah, the capital structure in the oil industry is one where you pay out everything you can right now, because you're afraid of regulation, you're afraid of political curfews, you're afraid of investing into it. And just look at the forward curve of oil, the discount between spot and 5 years out, 7 years out, which is the typical investment project, is about 50%. And no oil company is gonna be doing a lot of new exploration in that space. So you have a limited resource supply due to capital constraints and the cost of capital, coinciding with an economy where we are not getting the full what people hope for, a transformation into solar and energy and windmills and the likes. Hence, the net demand goes up. I mean, Kai, there's a reason why your iPhone gets bigger and bigger. It's not because it's smart. It's simply because your electricity consumption through your apps goes up somewhere between 15 and 25% a year. Technology-wise, we can catch up for 10 to 15%. So we leave a deficit of 10 to 25% in terms of electricity consumption. If AI is such a bigger success that everybody says it is, Look at the data centers consumption of energy. It's going exponentially. Cryptocurrencies, which is a favorite of many young people today, look at their energy consumption. Energy consumption is going through the roof. So it's really electricity that dictates and the use of electricity that dictates oil. And I don't see no letting go on the demand side of electricity.
Exactly. Now, cheap energy was the driver of all growth in the past. That's anywhere in the world, cheap energy opens the doors to prosperity. Like, simple as that, I think.
It's a simple most thing factor. If you said to me, you sort of said, Steen, you can only have one indicator that you can use to trade with. Which one would you keep? I would keep the oil prices.
Okay. Now, interesting. Steen, like, I promise you we'd do 30-ish minutes at the beginning. We're already at 35 and we still haven't really tackled two big topics. One, again, I want to get back to commodities. I'm really curious what do you think of Dr. Copper these days? I also threatened to talk about sort of the rate hike decisions this week from the BOJ, Bank of Japan, Bank of England, but also the Fed. But also one more big topic here is, where is it? I wrote it down. I need to find it. I'm missing it. Commodities. Sorry. I said commodities already. That's what I thought. Trying to make that segue. Maybe we'll make a hard cut here. Let's talk about commodities first, because China published some interesting data this morning as well from industrial production and industrial metrics, much higher than expected. 5% growth was expected. 7% was the real number that came in this morning. Sort of on what you've been mentioning as well. Are we at the do we see a global recovery happening right now as well? Is China that leading indicator that we should be looking at?
I thought China is the leading indicator, but I think it's an old theory that's been around for a long time. I think that what is really going to drive commodities up is the non-China imports, where China before, of course, was not only the catalyst, but also the impulse of the commodity cycle. I think what we see in terms of increase in military spending across the board, the whole NATO question, is, of course, a very commodity-heavy environment. I think that the underinvestment into the mining structure leaves mining stocks. I think it's a topic you follow quite closely on your channel. Probably the cheapest relatively to not only commodity, but the overall. And that has to do with the high real rates and the right cost of capital and of course, the regulatory framework. So commodities are under-owned, first of all, which is a good starting point. It is probably going to benefit the most if there is, as I predict, a rate cycle which is going to be to the downside. And if that rate cycle, as I also try to predict, which, and again, my predictions are worth zero, but if we're going to go back and at the end of the year we'll end up having 4 to 5 cuts instead of 2 to 3, I think commodities are off to the race. And net, the demand, as I said on the oil side, is not dissimilar in now taking in Dr. Copper. Copper is where most analysts see the biggest deficit in terms of actual production to supply. But that is also on the premise what is actually happening in the energy space and the distribution of energy space in terms of green transformation. So for every decision, I mean, you've got to create a decision tree, but I'll say right now the odds are pretty well stacked positive for Dr. Copper itself. But it's not a sign of the global recovery in growth. It's gotten too cheap relatively to other asset classes, but also too cheap to itself in the sense that the ability to extract from mines, they are losing on which is an important technical point. But the the grading of the ores are very, very poor. I mean, where you in the past could extract, 10-12%, you're down to 1-2% in a lot of these ores. So there's also a huge moving down the quality pattern in terms of what you get from these mines, on top of the very high cost funding cost, and an industry which is, of course, not by me and probably not by you, but by most people seen as something that you should avoid.
No, absolutely. Like the IRR of most mining projects in the copper space is below 20%. And that's even using like positive, price predictions here as well, using $4 a pound copper, for example, which is actually in the historical context, a very decent price for a pound of copper. But as you said, there are some very big dynamics at play that could push copper a lot higher. The supply and demand dynamics here. It's shocking. If you're outside the industry, something I definitely suggest to read up on, right? One topic you mentioned is the mining stocks. I quickly want to talk about that before we, you know, wrap up our conversation with a central bank discussion real quick as well, and sort of your expectations for the week. But the mining stocks, GDX, GDXJ as well. What are your thoughts on that, given also the gold price environment we're in?
I'm classically a macro drivers trader, so I like the first derivatives or the underlying better than the derivative. Mm-hmm. But I know the theme here is that if, as there has been, is a gold bull market developing, then normally you would have more leverage in the miners. But it goes back to what I just pointed out. I think the capital structure is too expensive, and I think the quality of the ores are just poor, which means that the actual output is doubtful. End of the day, that should increase the price, and that should increase that cycle. But you need... I think similar to a lot of other things. I think the first time Fed cuts interest rate, I think the miners is off to the race.
Fantastic. Awesome. No, I think that's what everybody's predicting. Let's fingers crossed that that's what's happening, because everybody's been predicting a recession.
Then I don't want to make that prediction. That's what everybody does.
Everybody's been predicting the recession that we're still waiting for as well. So we'll see how that goes. But Steen, one very last topic, because it is happening this week, we need to talk about central banks. And I want to talk about Japan in particular, because them changing or their policies actually in terms of interest rates going somewhat positive on the interest rate environment could have huge ramifications globally. And I'm talking about the yen carry trade here as well. Do you have a perspective on what Japan is going to do and also what the implications could be, even if it's just symbolic at first? Because even if it's 0.1%, I don't think it'll move a lot of dollars. But I think the symbolism here is quite important.
So what people need to understand about Japan, and I'm fortunate enough to go to Japan a couple of times a year, is that it's a consumption-driven economy. So all of the banks has been told that there will be a hike, or at least a communication of hikes coming in Japan. I'll be very surprised if they didn't do a move where they move from negative to zero. But as you say, probably the more important part is the projection that they're going to put out, the outlook on what's going to happen between now and October. Some of the more aggressive Japanese banks are calling for an additional 25 basis point by October. I think that will dictate it. But the fact of the matter is, and which is slightly, you know, annoying, at least for me as a trader, is that I don't think dollar yen knows that there is a Bank of Japan meeting overnight going on, because Bank of Japan, dollar yen sits at almost $150 to the yen, and yen to the dollar, sorry. And you know, it's so pre-announced, it's so premeditated, it's so leaked in Japan that's really what people need to understand, that Bank of Japan has surprised in the past, but it is not their strategy to surprise. So unless they are trying to achieve a dramatic change, as you say, on the capital flow, on the structure of the capital market, but all of the Japanese banks are, as of today, positioned for interest rate to go to zero tomorrow. So I think that out of the way. And let me just take quickly the other two to get you shorter out of this program. Federal Reserve March meeting is a difficult one, because it sits in between getting new data and still waiting for that first labor market data to deteriorate enough for them to actually move the needle. But I think people will focus on two or three dots, as you know already. I don't think that's relevant, but I think that's what people focus about. Focus on. I think it's going to be very difficult for them to move from three to two, simply because it is an election year. I think the policy signal embedded in that they may not cut interest rate, or they are sort of moving back on it, makes it almost impossible for them to move on. And then I think the majority of their talk internally will be on, well, how to deal with this QT situation, which, as we pointed out, between the two of us, liquidity is as constrained as we come out of March into April, and April will be a huge test for the liquidity in the system. And as such, I think that is probably not what the market sees, but I think thinking like Powell and try to reverse engineer how he's been communicating in the past, I think he's more concerned about the liquidity question than he is about his starts, because they say themselves the dust doesn't really matter. We know it doesn't matter, but even they seem to know. And it's very rare you have central banks admitting they don't know what they're talking about. But in this case, they have said that in the past. And Bank of England, they are simply not in a position yet, because what is happening in the UK is that the increase in electricity prices and the support for those electricity prices to the UK consumer is going away on April 1st. So the Bank of England really wants to see what happens in April when the prices come down. It's very likely that the headline inflation in the UK will get very close to 2% already in Q2, which will leave the room open for them a little bit later to start cutting interest rate. But Bank of England, so in sequence here, it's pretty clear ECB will cut in April. I think Federal Reserve is more likely than not to cut in May. And I think Bank of England is probably trying to do one in June.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, I wrote that down. April, ECB, May, Fed, and June, BOE. So fantastic. I've written that down. Because the Fed is like, but the EU, like Christine Lagarde said, we haven't even talked about it in the past. So I'm really curious how quickly that tone is going to change here in the future. Stine, thank you so much for your time. It was a fantastic discussion. I know we could have gone down a lot more rabbit holes, like liquidity impacts from the Bank of Japan decision, I think, is something we could have spent a bit more time on in context of what we discussed the first part of our conversation as well, with the bank term funding program and the reverse repo facility and just liquidity drainage out of the U.S. as well. So really, really interesting topic. Where can we follow your work, Stine? Where can we follow your predictions? And I think you have a newsletter or at least a blog on the website as well.
Yeah, Saxo's research is on something called analysis.saxo, and Saxo is a XO. And I'm on Twitter as Steen_Jacobson, my name you see on the screen. You can follow me there. I'm not a prolific tweeter or writer of research because, to be honest, I don't really think I have a lot to offer anybody else. I'm just trying to keep an even keel and be humble about what I consider not only the best, but also the most difficult job in the world to be in these markets.
Absolutely. Being a CIO right now, I don't think that's an easy job at all, right? Given all the news and noise around us right now. So I have a lot of respect for that. So it's not easy, and really appreciative of your time. Stine, thank you so much, and hope to have you back soon to sort of follow up on the discussion, especially the April, May, and June predictions here as well. So, no, thanks so much for your time, and everybody else, thank you so much for tuning in. This was SOAR Financially, and we were joined by the Saxo Bank CIO, Stine Jacobson. If you liked the conversation, please leave a like. It helps us tremendously gauge whether you thought our guest was interesting, whether we asked the right questions, whether the conversation was of value to you, and of course, leave a comment. Should we ask different questions? What do you think? When is the ECB cutting? Because I'm personally thinking there is a bit of a race to cut between the US and the EU, just from an investment perspective as well, because everybody wants to be more attractive. And what does that mean? What's the rat tail behind the rate cut decision as well? What is happening and what is the investment attractiveness? Really appreciate you joining in. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for getting educated and making informed investment decisions. We'll be back with lots more here on SOAR Financially. Thank you.